Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Founding father Thomas Jefferson famously owned a Quran and placed it beside the Old Testament in his library. Muslims were extremely rare back then in America, or invisible, toiling as African slaves. But a new book says Jefferson made his case for separation of church and state by arguing that even Muslims should be free citizens of these United States. This hour on Point, Jefferson's Quran. You can join us on air or online. Does it surprise you that a founding father owned a Quran and thought about Islam and freedom in the earliest days of this nation? What does this tell you about Thomas Jefferson? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Tom Ashbrook is away visiting member station KVCR in San Bernardino, California. He'll be back tomorrow. Later in the hour today, we'll speak to Congressman Keith Ellison, the first Muslim elected to Congress who famously placed his hand on Thomas Jefferson's Quran for his swearing in. But first, from Austin, Texas, I'm joined by Denise Spellberg, professor of history and Middle Eastern studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Her new book is called Jefferson's Quran, Islam and the Founders. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. So nice to have you with us, Denise.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be here.
So you write that in 1765, 11 years before he wrote the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson bought a Quran. Tell us the story.
Well, he was 22 years old. He was a law student. And it's likely that, like many Europeans before him, he thought of the Quran as a book of law, which is probably why he purchased it. We have the notation of this purchase at his local paper, the Williamsburg Gazette, and he would have ordered the book there, and they would have shipped it from London, where it was translated.
So put it into context then. Were sales of the Quran common at that time? Sounds like not. He was a law student. He was looking at it purely for an academic, from an academic perspective?
You know, it's likely that law was the premier reason that he wanted to look at the Quran. He was buying other law books at the same time. But the fact is that this particular translation was unique in some ways, and it was a sensation in Europe. It was the first time the Quran had been translated directly from Arabic to English. And it provided the most accurate translation then available, together with a 200-page introduction that was really also extremely balanced in its analysis of Islam as a faith of ritual and law, and one that contained the basic beliefs. So Jefferson didn't just buy a Quran. He bought an introduction to the religion that was more even-handed than anything that had gone before it.
So were American notions of Islam and Muslims then at the time formed mostly by European beliefs?
Yes, it looks like Americans inherited pretty directly quite negative views of Islam from European Christians. And they had held these really since the inception of the religion. But, you know, what's interesting is that Jefferson absorbed these negative ideas, but he had them also about other organized religions, including Judaism and Christianity. So it's not just Islam that he wanted to interrogate. It's likely that it wasn't just a law interest, but also a religious form of inquiry for him.
Were there Muslims in North America in Jefferson's time in the 18th century?
Yes, there were. And there had been Muslims in North America since the 17th century. The irony of this is that Jefferson appears not to have recognized them as inhabitants of his British colony of Virginia, or later in the United States. All of his knowledge about Muslims and Islam was learned from books, with two exceptions. He met two Muslim ambassadors during his life in public service. But other than that, he never made the connection between Islam as an American religion and Muslims living even in his own state, although they certainly must have.
Is that because most of them were slaves? Was there any knowledge of free Muslims? Were there traders and the like?
It seems that the majority of Muslims in the founding era, and even before this in the 17th century, were not free. They were enslaved West Africans. Historians have tried to put a numerical figure on how many Muslims there were in the United States or in North America before the founding, but it's very hard to determine. Usually, people make a stab at this based on names. So, for example, I've looked at Jefferson's very detailed list of slave names, and none of them appear particularly Islamic. On the other hand, George Washington, who was his close neighbor in 1774, among his taxable items, listed two women slaves whom he referred to as Fatima, or his accountant did, Fatima and Little Fatima. And Fatima is the name of the prophet's daughter. So we know that George Washington owned Muslim slaves. But again, Washington believed in these theoretical rights for people of all religions, including Muslims explicitly. But he also never made the connection between Islam on his plantation as attached to an enslaved African.
You write in the book, Denise Spellberg, that, quote, at a time when most Americans were uninformed, misinformed, or simply afraid of Islam, Thomas Jefferson imagined Muslims as future citizens of this new nation. So what was his vision?
Well, you know, as early as 1776, we have notes that he took from John Locke, who was a 17th century English theorist and philosopher. And in his own hand, we have Jefferson writing, based on Locke's precedent, neither pagan nor Mohammedan, meaning Muslim, nor Jew, ought to be excluded from the civil rights of the Commonwealth because of his religion. And those are powerful words, actually. Locke theorized them, but Jefferson really tried to incorporate them into his actual Virginia legislation. And we know that in 1786, his bill for establishing religious freedom in Virginia, also known as the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, passed in the legislature. And that was the first piece of legislation in the United States that guaranteed both freedom of religion and political equality, regardless of religion.
And one of the great achievements of Jefferson's life, correct?
Absolutely. One of the three great achievements that he insisted before his death be put on his tombstone. 5 years before he died, and after going to war with Muslim powers in North Africa, Jefferson still insisted that this mantle of protection, as he called it, was universal. And he explicitly said it was meant to include the Jew and the Gentile, the Mohammedan, the Hindu, and the infidel of every denomination. Hmm. So he saw in including Muslims not only the farthest parameters of inclusion, but the notion of universality itself. If you include Muslims who were then among the most despised practitioners of religion in the world, then you had to include everybody else.
How was it?
And isn't just – sorry.
No, I'm just curious. How was it you decided to write this book?
Well, the idea came about somewhat slowly. I happened upon a broadside for a play about the Prophet Muhammad that was performed by the British in New York during the Revolutionary War in 1780, and then 2 years later by American rebels in Baltimore. And I had no clue as a professor of Islamic history that Americans had thought about Islam at all. So that was a kind of a wake-up call. You know, there are a couple of books that document the negative view that most early Americans had of Islam. But what I began to find was that there was this alternative vision. And it was in the debate over religious toleration that evolved into rights, especially religious liberty, that I began to see that Muslims were actually part of that discussion. And I think that they were really more than placeholders, that they became part of a real blueprint for a fully inclusive American future where everyone, regardless of religion, would have rights.
You actually made a trip to the rare book room at the Library of Congress to see Jefferson's copy of the Quran. I'm curious what that was like.
It was completely thrilling, and it was also somewhat startling because what I did is what any citizen can do, which is to get their borrower card from the Library of Congress, get the call number of Jefferson's two-volume translation of the Quran, present it in the rare book room, and then 10 minutes later, this person put the two volumes that Jefferson had owned in front of me. And I was able to open them up and look inside, and it was really startling because at the time there was that incident in Florida where this pastor of a very small congregation had threatened to burn the Quran. So I couldn't believe I was holding in my hands the very Quran that Jefferson had owned and one that he initialed too. Those are the only marks Jefferson put in the Quran, just his initials in the first volume at the bottom of one page. And what's startling, too, is that the volume is old, right? I mean, it's 1765 it was published, and it crackles, and you can see how it's sort of yellowing and getting old. So I was very careful with it, and I'm sure the Library of Congress is, too.
In our last 30 seconds here, before we go to break, I'm curious what was most interesting to you in the research. I have so many questions to you, for you about Jefferson himself, but what was most interesting to you as you researched this book?
I think what startled me is that Muslims were often linked with Jews in the debates on toleration and full inclusion of citizenship. And that is interesting to me because usually scholars of Jews in early America focus on Jews only. But in fact, in debates about inclusion or exclusion, Jews and Muslims were often coupled together.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're looking at a fascinating new book about the earliest traces of Islam in this country and how that religion and its followers were seen by colonial Americans. Here's a clip we heard referenced in our first segment. Pastor Terry Jones of Florida got worldwide attention for repeated threats to set fire to copies of the Quran and sometimes making good on those threats. As recently as September 11th of this year, he was arrested as he was about to set fire to nearly 3,000 kerosene-soaked Korans at a park in Polk County, Florida. Here he was talking to CNN in the summer of 2010, once again threatening to burn Korans on 9/11 of that year, although he backed down on that occasion.
What we are also doing by the burning of the Quran on 9/11, we're saying stop. We're saying stop to Islam, stop to Islamic law, stop to brutality.
My guest this hour is Denise Spellberg, professor of history and Middle Eastern studies at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Jefferson's Quran, Islam, and the Founders. I'm curious, Denise, did Jefferson ever talk about or write about his Quran and what he thought specifically of its contents? What were his attitudes about it?
It was one of the most vexing parts of this project that I was not able to find notes from Jefferson, who took notes about quite a lot of things in the period after he bought this Quran. There are just no notes, either in the Quran or in separate papers preserved about what he thought about the Quran directly. And this might be because 5 years after he purchased the sacred text, he had there was a fire that destroyed all his books and papers. And he says that only one book was saved. So, in fact, the question is, you know, did he take notes and were those burned? And also, did he buy the Quran a second time? We can't know that. But we can know sort of from circumstantial evidence that his ideas about Islam were variable and, again, in some ways contradictory. So at the beginning of his political career, he used Islam as a sort of straw man to argue against when proposing bills for religious liberty and the elimination of a religious establishment. And this was sort of standard. He used the Ottomans as a caricature of the absence of rights, of a site of despotism and tyranny. And this is something that the British, especially the Whigs, had pioneered. The Ottomans were tyrannical, and the English had liberties and individual rights. And Jefferson sort of forwarded that idea in the 1770s when passing new legislation in Virginia. And we have his debate notes on that. But toward the end of his political career, we also see that he clearly understood the central tenet of Islam as an uncompromising monotheism. And when he wrote his private letters to the rulers of North African Islamic states, he ended them with a benediction, which most historians have not noted, but which I find very curious and interesting. He said things like, "I pray God, very great and respected friend, to have you always in his holy keeping." And that's a line that sounds at least as if Jefferson was deploying his understanding of Islam, which posits that Jews and Christians received revelation from the same God that Muslims worship, that Jefferson was willing to employ that in his practical diplomacy. Now, whether he appreciated it or not is somewhat of an open question, although by this time he had become very interested in Unitarianism. And that's a faith that, like Islam, believes that Jesus was a moral exemplar but not divine, and denies, for example, the resurrection. So there is a sense in which we could argue that he was a very serious diplomat and that he was willing to speak to people in terms that they understood religiously, while on the other hand, perhaps not entirely rejecting the notion that there was one God for Muslims as well as himself.
What about the role of religion in citizenship, broadly speaking? How Jefferson's study of Islam and his interactions with Muslims had a major impact on that thinking. It was really fundamental to his ideas about religious tolerance, was it not?
Well, in terms of citizenship, what seems to have been fundamental to him was the principle of universality. And that he seems not to have drawn from an Islamic precedent, which is interesting because there were lots of Europeans who knew, for example, that in Islam there was a form of religious toleration, albeit qualified, for non-Muslims, especially for Jews and Christians who were called people of the book. Many European thinkers, especially in times of religious strife, referred to the Ottoman precedent, but Jefferson didn't. Instead, you know, he relied seemingly exclusively on John Locke and others, and a notion of the separation of religion from government that would protect all people, including Muslims. And of course, what's interesting is that by the time he talked about his bill in 1821, the Bill for Establishing Religious Freedom, and how it protected everyone, including infidels of every denomination, by this time, Jefferson had long been assaulted politically with the term infidel, which in the 18th century and for a couple of hundred centuries before didn't mean just bad Christian. It meant Muslim.
Well, he was assaulted by John Adams, right? Who likened Jefferson
by John Quincy Adams?
Yes,
that's right.
Yes,
writing on behalf of his father in 1791, Jefferson inadvertently endorsed Thomas Paine's tract, and in the introduction, in among these phrases, he said that the tract by Paine, it was considered basically an atheist at the time, would counteract certain apostasies or certain political views that were then considered to be divergent from the idea of democracy. And of course, Adams read this and realized that it was directed at him because he had just written a tract that seemed to support British ideas of monarchy and aristocracy, although he denied it. And John Quincy Adams, Adams' son, wrote in a Boston paper comparing Jefferson to the prophet Muhammad, and not in a good way, and saying basically that Jefferson was a sort of fanatic and that he was forcing people to think about religion and politics in only the way he perceived them. So this was a knock against Jefferson that was translated through an anti-Islamic filter. And that's the first time he was attacked that way. It would happen again in the 1800 election when Jefferson and Adams squared off for the presidency.
So fascinating. Let's go to the phones. Hales Corner, Wisconsin. Lori's on the line. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
And hi, guest. I guess I forgot your name.
Denise Spellberg.
Thank you. I'm calling because years ago, my husband and I visited Monticello, and we were shown Jefferson's version of the Bible. Not version exactly. He had taken things out of the Bible and
yes.
kind of eliminated them, right?
Yes,
and
exactly.
This my impression is that he was doing that with these other writings, the Quran, etc. And I think it was his sort of a scholarly approach to determine what would be good for ruling the country, policies and legislation that would work for all people in the country.
Mm-hmm. Laurie, thank you. Denise Spellberg.
Well, actually, you know, Jefferson did take a razor to the New Testament. He did this when he was out of political office. He didn't do it with any other text, not the Quran, not the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. He did this seemingly not as a policy attempt, but because he was trying as a rationalist, a deist, and a Unitarian to create a version of the Gospels for himself based only on the verses he could believe in. And so he excised miracles. He excised the virgin birth. He excised the resurrection of Jesus. He excised all the miracles that Jesus wrought. And so it's a very interesting theological study. And, of course, it comes to be known as the Jefferson Bible. But he would never have made this thing public. It only came to the attention of his heirs, and we have it now as he excised it. But it was an exercise, really, in his rationalism and his attempt to apply rational principles to religion.
Talk about the Founding Fathers' notions of religious plurality and tolerance and the pressure and the voices at the time which were calling for the United States really to be a Protestant country.
Yes, certainly. What's interesting in this mix, in this debate, is that it was exceptionally Protestant, that there were no other voices. We had maybe 2,000 Jews in the country and 25,000 Catholics, and these folks were unaware of Muslim slaves who, in any event, because they were unfree, had no rights anyway. So we don't have Muslim voices in this. But we do have Protestants who were fighting a battle often against one another for supremacy in the various states. At the time before the Constitution, there were religious tests that officials for public office had to take. And these included swearing to the truth of the Old and the New Testament, which excluded Jews. In many states, there were exclusionary statements about Catholics as threats to the state. And so Protestants were on the one hand wary of each other because they expected another establishment of religion. They expected it to be a form of Protestantism. In North Carolina, for example, before the ratification of the Constitution, one swore to the truth of the Protestant faith, which obviously excluded Catholics and Jews. But what's really interesting is that in proposing in the Constitution's Article 6, Section 3, the abolition of a religious test, Protestants exclusively in debates about the Constitution began to see that not only would this end an establishment of a particular kind of Protestantism, but it might open the door to power for non-Protestants. And so there were actually debates in which Protestant delegates to the ratification of the Constitution in each state worried about a Jew or a Catholic or a Muslim president. And yet, in places where Protestants suffered because there were, for example, in Virginia, where there was an establishment of Anglican Protestantism or what today we would call Episcopalianism in the U.S., there were Protestants there who petitioned Jefferson and wrote things like, "Let Jews, Mohammedans, and Christians of every denomination enjoy religious liberty and thrust them not out by establishing the Christian religion, lest thereby they become our enemies and weaken this infant state." So there were people who were not famous, like Jefferson or even Washington, who understood in their own self-interest that no form of Christianity really was the best way to tolerate, include, and make equal all believers. And many of them saw beyond the Christian religion in this. Jefferson is exceptional, but he's not alone in his vision.
Let's go to the phones. Matt is in Northfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I really appreciated the direction that this conversation was going, talking about basically the defense of all religions as a key point to our early founders, and especially Jefferson. I think so many times people look at the separation of religion and state, and meaning that they should have absolutely nothing to do with one another, as opposed to the wanting the government to have a fundamental interest in defending all religions, which was such a big reason why so many people emigrated to the United States from Europe and all over the world, so they could freely practice their religion of choice, whether that was some sect of Protestantism, Catholicism, or anything else.
Matt, thank you. Matt's call, Denise Spellberg, makes me think about the Founding Fathers' thoughts about those with no faith. Did that ever come up?
Yes. Jefferson was not averse to atheists, although they would never have been, you know, they would never have been as individuals a recognized presence in the United States. They certainly were not. But this is where he moved ahead of European thinkers who thought that atheists, because they couldn't swear an oath based on their being punished or rewarded in the afterlife, this is where Jefferson superseded them all. And I take the caller's point about a defense of all religions as really a tenet of the founding ideals of Jefferson, of Washington, and even James Madison. A lot of people argue that the country was founded as a Christian country, but there were many founders who believed in what we would call today religious pluralism, and they articulated this repeatedly in their works. So, you know, this notion of a universal inclusion is an important one in founding history.
Here's David in Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, David. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, this is a really good subject. I've done a lot of study and research concerning the founding and Jefferson as well, and I think that during the time that Jefferson was, you know, kind of delving into this whole Muslim thing and different religions within the United States was shortly after 1753, when Vettel created the Law of Nations and put all of that in text. And you know, he was very conflicted with that, because at the time, before the Constitution was passed, you know, all of our states were sovereign states. They were sovereign nations. At that time, they could have put into effect, and he saw this I guess this power that states had at that time, they all could have determined that their own religion per state. And I believe that he feared that, and that it was going to cause a problem later on for citizenship and laws and legislation and what have you. And but the founding fathers at the same point were not going to let that happen, if, you know, moving to more of a federalist central control of government. But I think a lot of people take out of context the statement of, you know, separation of church and state. It primarily and solely speaks to that the central government will not determine, even though they have the rights based on the Law of Nations, but they would not determine one central religion for the entire country. However, before that, you know, the states could have chosen to determine a religion.
To separate by religion. David, thank you. It's a good point. Denise Spellberg, was that a concern of the Founding Fathers, a separation of states by religion?
They wanted one rule to serve for all, certainly. And this worked at the federal level. But interestingly enough, for the First Amendment, even when the First Amendment was passed, there were still states, such as Massachusetts, in fact, and Connecticut, that had an establishment of religion, and that was Congregationalism into the 19th century.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Jefferson's Quran this hour, relevant to him back then and relevant to us today as Muslims have entered the American mainstream and as we engage in war and peace with Islamic peoples around the world. My guest this hour is Denise Spellberg, author of Jefferson's Quran, Islam and the Founders. Denise, how did Islam impact Jefferson's diplomacy, per se?
Well, you know, he had two encounters directly with Muslim diplomats. One in London in 1786, when he and John Adams, who were both ambassadors abroad, met with the representative from Tripoli in what is today Libya, And they had a face-to-face negotiation about whether the United States would be able to purchase a treaty of protection for civilian shipping and seamen. And the problem was that the United States did not have the requisite funds to pay the tribute needed to get a treaty of peace. This became an increasing problem when American ships were seized in the Eastern Atlantic and the Mediterranean by Islamic powers. And interestingly, in that negotiation, the ambassador claimed that the Quran supported the seizure of non-Muslim shipping and civilians. And what's interesting is that Jefferson, long after this, may well have initialed the page of the Quran he did because he was checking to see if the ambassador's reading of the Quran was correct. Hmm. And many people suspect that Jefferson bought his Quran based on this interaction or the trouble the United States had with these North African corsairing powers. But he bought the Quran 11 years before the Declaration of Independence. He also entertained the first – Jefferson entertained the first Muslim ambassador to the United States from Tunis. And because it was Ramadan, Jefferson changed the time of a state dinner from 3:30 to sunset. So he was respectful of Islam. And as I mentioned before, in his diplomatic letters, his closing with the benediction that invoked a shared God was a real sign that he was understanding Islam and even supporting that understanding to further better diplomatic relations with states that were actually even at war with the United States at the time.
Here's a call from Dan in Northbridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks a lot. This is a great show. I'm really enjoying this. But I just wanted to make a comment about Jefferson's Bible that a previous caller made. And your guest said that this was something that was not meant to be public, but that was just for Jefferson's private use. And my understanding of this text is that it was, in theory, meant for the public, that it was meant as a way of creating a rational religion that was just based on a sort of rational ethics that could be used by citizens of a republic. And I think this is important for understanding Jefferson's notion of pluralism, because Jefferson was very discriminating about religion and about the effects that different kinds of religions had on Republican citizenship. He was very critical, for instance, of Judaism, fair or not, and I believe also, as I recall, critical of Islam on some points as well. So I just wanted to make the point that there's pluralism, which is something we believe in today and something we value greatly. I don't think we can make Jefferson a religious pluralist in that sense, in the sense that there are many aspects of many religions that he thought were damaging to Republican citizenship. And those are the kind of things that he wanted to excise, not just from the Christian Bible, but from religious experience generally.
Dan, thank you. Denise Spellberg?
Well, you know, this is an interesting point. The fact is that Jefferson was very wary and told his correspondents after writing in 1784, publishing some views on religion in his Notes on Virginia. And that's when he said, "It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." For that, he got into a world of trouble that was far too expansive and inclusive a view of religion to be made public in the 18th century. So I would, you know, I think that the caller is right that Jefferson saw a future in which ideally Americans would believe in a kind of rationalized sort of form of civic something. But it's pretty clear that he didn't wish to get into matters religious in public ever after 1784, particularly because he took such a beating over and being called an infidel, among other things, in 1791 and again in the presidential contest. As far as his Bible is concerned, you know, this is a man who predicted that all of the United States would become Unitarian, too. So even though that was his direction of thought, this rationalist application, you know, it's not clear what he projected for the rest of the country. The notion seems to be, of course, that religion for him was more of an interior matter than a public expression of faith. And so this notion of rational religion was his, but his alone. And that Bible does not come into the public purview until long after his death.
Dan, thank you for the call. Here's Brad in Canton, New York. Hi, Brad. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just want to ask a question about the influence of his Anglican religion and his early childhood on my great-great-grandfather's Tuckahoe Plantation, where he learned to read and write with them, with their siblings in his one-room schoolhouse across from the slave quarters. And he repeated the Lord's Prayer over and over and over after he was kidded by my relatives and his siblings about being so shy and so soft-spoken. I wonder if the Lord's Prayer had much influence and the early exposure to Anglicanism and the slavery.
Brad, thank you. Denise Spellberg.
Well, he never denied that he was an Anglican. It was a form of identity that he retained until his death. But I think maybe his animating principle was best stated by him a few years before he died, when he wrote with advice to a friend's son, and he said, "Love your neighbor as yourself, and your country more than yourself." So for him, the golden rule seems to have been the operative principle. And the fact that his neighbors might not be Christian bothered him not at all.
Here's Barbara in Middletown, Connecticut. Hi, Barbara. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just returned last night from Istanbul, Turkey. And as you know, Turkey is about 98.5% Muslim. Well, while we were there, my husband and I one morning had a very long conversation with our desk clerk, who's Kurdish but became converted to Islam. And so in our conversation about the U.S. policies and how it influences Turkey and his view of the world and our view of the world, I had pointed out to him that, yes, we were a Christian country, but one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, actually owned and had read a Quran. And he had no idea that we, didn't know much about our founding fathers. But I wanted to point out that we aren't as closed-minded as a society as they might think. Being in Turkey, people were very nice, but I think that they were very polite and sometimes didn't tell us what they were thinking.
Barbara, thank you very much for the call. Very interesting. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining us from Minneapolis is Keith Ellison, Democratic congressman representing Minnesota's 5th District and co-chair of the Progressive Caucus. He's the first Muslim American elected to Congress. Congressman Ellison, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've had this lovely conversation this hour about Thomas Jefferson's Quran, and I'm curious what the reaction was when you decided to use Thomas Jefferson's Quran to be sworn in as the first Muslim member of Congress.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, you know, because when I was at the very end of the campaign at the general election in 2006, you know, I come from a pretty Democratic district. I had won the primary, so it looked like we had a pretty good shot at winning. And I was on a late night television cable show that was in Somali. And the interviewer asked me, "If you win the election, will you swear in on the Quran?" And I said, "You know, we haven't even won yet. I'm not thinking about swearing in. I'm thinking about trying to get enough votes to win this election." And then he pushed back and he said, "Well, if you win, you know, will you swear in on the Quran?" I said, "I don't know. I haven't thought that far." He said, "Can you imagine winning?" And I said, "Yes. What are you swearing in on when you do?" I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll swear in on the Quran." So I didn't think much of it. And then, you know, my head went immediately back into trying to win the general. And then we did win. And then the next thing you know, there was a torrent of attention on us, you know, being the first Muslim elected, you know, only a few years after 9/11. You know, we got more than our fair share of attention. And then one day, you know, sifting through all the mail we were getting, we got a letter that was handwritten in which somebody, the writer, whose name I have not disclosed, but whose name I do know, said, you should swear in on Jefferson's Quran. We all looked at each other and said, "This is a brilliant idea." So then we called up the Library of Congress, and we already had the reference number because it was in the letter. And they said, "Yeah, we'd be happy to do it." But we kept it under wraps until the fateful day. And then there was all kinds of attention. Dennis Prager was saying we were, you know, threatening Western civilization and worse than Osama bin Laden. That was a whole lot of hyperbole, but it ended up being a good thing.
So with all that attention, I'm curious, what do you think Thomas Jefferson would have thought of your election as the first Muslim represented in Congress and the fact that you were swearing in on his Quran?
I think he'd have been delighted by it. Everything I've read about Thomas Jefferson and religious liberty indicates that he believed that religion shouldn't divide Americans. And it's not only in the First Amendment where it says Congress shall make no law establishing religion or abridging the free exercise thereof. Later on, the Quran says that there shall be no religious test to hold office. And of course, before Jefferson actually pulled together a piece of legislation when he was a Virginia legislator detailing religious liberty. So this is something that I think is a key part of who Thomas Jefferson was, to make sure that this new American nation would not be divided by religion. Of course, we've had a lot of ups and downs with religion, like any nation has, but our in the area of religious liberty, we have good foundation. And it's because of Jefferson, but also Washington, also Franklin, all made very important statements about religious liberty.
Congressman Ellison, I want to ask you what you make of some of the rhetoric, though, that still surrounds Islam and Muslims in this country. Here's some sound from this past June, speaking from the House floor. Texas Tea Party Representative Louie Gohmert said organizations like CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, were working to undermine the U.S. Constitution.
The evidence shows that CARE, the Islamic Society of North America, those are front organizations for the Muslim Brotherhood. They want Sharia law to be the law of the land, not our Constitution. And that is what we did not take an oath to allow to happen.
Congressman Ellison, how do you handle that in Congress? And do you see generally Americans viewing Islam and Muslims as a threat broadly to American culture?
You know, with all due respect to my friend Louie Gohmert, he's just 100% wrong. You know, he's incorrect there. You know, that kind of statement is not, you know, an isolated one. There have been other sort of things. My my colleague Michelle Bachman, whose office is right, whose district is next to mine, you know, started this, sent a whole bunch of letters suggesting that the Muslim Brotherhood was infiltrating the American government, and that Huma Abedin, the former aide of Hillary Clinton, was amongst those. And she added in a few others. And of course, there, you know, there was a time when Tom Tancredo said that if there was another terrorist attack, that the United States should bomb Mecca. You know, and so the bottom line is there's been inflammatory comments made here and there. But I can assure you, the overwhelming number of members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, don't share those views and are actually more interested in building common ground. I can tell you that it's not nearly as high profile, but, you know, people on both sides of the aisle routinely, you know, talk to me you know, how do Muslims, you know, see America? How can we integrate? How can we make sure that, you know, there's one America? Now, we can fall out over taxes and spending, but I think there's a general consensus that religion should not divide us. And that's despite some of the more inflammatory comments that you may have heard.
Denise Spellberg, after all your research and study, I'm curious if you have any thoughts about Congressman Ellison's election and just generally his thoughts.
Well, I was very interested to note that when Congressman Ellison was elected, he wrote an editorial which I think was titled Choose Generosity, Not Exclusion. And in it, he basically rearticulated this idea of the golden rule, which is something that comes up repeatedly, really from the 16th century on, in Christian writing that proposed religious toleration that included Muslims. And as I noted, Jefferson, at the end of his life, said, love your neighbor as yourself and your country more than yourself. And I think that Jefferson would indeed have been delighted to see that his blueprint for inclusion of Muslims worked out to a history that included Keith Ellison's election, which is something I think that he intended in his 18th century thought.
Denise, wrap us up here and describe this sort of historical moment in the long arc of this country's religious history and everything that you learned about Thomas Jefferson and his interest and engagement with Islam.
Well, I think what's important about thinking of the founders as inclusive, especially Jefferson, especially Washington and Madison, is that we are now in a period where Muslims are asserting their civil rights and where some people are trying to check that. and linking them to all sorts of conspiracy theories and plots against the government or suggesting they're a fifth column. What's interesting to me is that all of these things have been all of these threats and all of these accusations have also been leveled against Jews and Catholics in the 19th century and into the 20th century, where Jews and Catholics were also considered outliers in the founding and had to struggle for their civil rights right into the 20th century. I think that Muslims are in that position today. And if we think of these three groups as a triad, then it's time for Muslims to assert themselves in a civil context, as Keith Ellison has done, and for other Muslims to see that there's a place for them in this country and that they have a right to the same rights as all other Americans.
It is fascinating work. Denise Spellberg's new book is Thomas Jefferson's Quran, Islam and the Founders. Denise Spellberg, thank you very, very much for your time today.
Thank you, Jane. It's been a pleasure.
And Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota's 5th District. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
Awesome. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.